Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio in Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today I'm joined by Leslie Bloom, a woman of many hats, an author, a journalist, and one of my favorite cultural observers in New York City. She's just released her wildly popular book, Let's Bring Back the Cocktail Edition. So Leslie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I'm so happy to be here. This is so cool.
So before we discuss this amazing book, I would love to discuss your background because you have a really, really colorful and amazing kind of story to tell. And, you know, you've worn so many hats. You have written children's books. You've been a reporter and researcher for ABC's Nightline. You've lived in Amman, Jordan. You currently write about a wide list of topics that cover culture, media, politics, and fashion, just to name a few. And tell me more about you.
Oh, God.
tell me about how you got into all of these things.
Well, I mean, I guess the common thread among all the things that I have done, it's all about storytelling. And I grew up in a storytelling family. My dad was a journalist, and he was Cronkite's producer in the 60s and 70s. So I grew up in a newsroom environment, so I always kind of knew that was the direction I was going to go in. So, you know, all the way through college and grad school, I was in newsrooms whenever I was, you know, interning. I interned at CBS, and then I worked at the Jordan Times in Amman, which was pretty incredible. And when I graduated from grad school, I went straight into news. I was working for ABC News Nightline, and that was incredibly intense. Was there through 9/11, Afghanistan, second Iraq invasion, election of 2000. It was pretty insane. And then I ultimately went independent and began writing instead. And so I've just been a freelance journalist since I left TV news, and I've just done a wide array of other writing, you know, fiction, nonfiction, books, articles, and I just sometimes I can't believe that this gets to be my job, because I get to meet fascinating people and write about unusual lives. And I think that, you know, there are a couple of categories of topic that are most interesting to me, but I really like unlikely character scenarios. So a lot of my articles end up being about people who are doing unusual things that you wouldn't expect that type of person to be doing. And I also just really like covering people of high creativity. So that's kind of what I'm up to in life.
What are some of the favorite places that you've visited or been able to cover topics on in the world?
Oh, God, so many. I mean, you know, working at Nightline, I was there when Ted Koppel was there, and that was a hell of an education, because you were covering topics that you weren't necessarily interested in at first, but then you would learn so much about the world, whether it was covering a topic in, you know, inner city LA, or you were doing something in, like, the, I don't know, suburbs of Phoenix or wherever. But I just did a really great story for Departures magazine, which is it's a luxury magazine, but they have a really awesome staff and do really great features. And so I was covering this guy who has this artisanal book binding and publishing house, and it's incredible. I mean, his employees are they're using, you know, 16th century Florentine methods of putting together books and dyeing papers and that kind of thing. And he's like this fusty Harvard educated Pooh Bear type guy wearing a three-piece suit and little glasses. And he's, but the big story is that his headquarters, it's not, you know, in Brooklyn, it's in Newburgh, which, you know, for many years has been considered the murder capital of New York State. And, you know, the FBI has had to devote, you know, tons of resources to dealing with gang warfare there. And here's this guy, you know, who's like this, I mean, he literally looks like he should be an A.A. Milne book. And he's running this factory. All the people who work in his factory, for the most part, are locals. And it's just this heartbreaking, incredible operation. And so sometimes I feel like, I mean, I've traveled everywhere. I've been from, you know, Maldives to Syria to, you know, everywhere. And, but sometimes you really, the best stories are 90 minutes north of your home in Manhattan.
So growing up, you know, what influences beyond your parents do you think kind of helped bring the topics and the drive that you have and the curiosity that you have to what you're doing?
I mean, honestly, I feel like I really need to credit my parents first and foremost. I mean, you know, again, my father being a journalist and my mother was a concert pianist. And so the house was always filled with really interesting people who were up to, you know, often bizarre things. And they were well-traveled and they were always doing kind of far-fetched things. I mean, we had everybody in the family from, you know, African art dealers to, you know, really hardcore lawyers to, you know, we had this one woman who had been a professional courtesan at one point, and she used to sleep in a coffin in her kitchen. I'm not joking. So it just definitely, you know, created a particular kind of mentality, I suppose. And also we were a really big reading family. And I think that just really helped set the tone. I mean, in every single room in our house, there were, you know, dozens if not hundreds of books. And I think that really kind of shaped a particular kind of curiosity.
So let's talk about the Let's Bring Back series and tell me about how this whole project came about.
So many years ago, 2007, Huffington Post was expanding from just being a political paper to launching a bunch of verticals that were, you know, life, arts, that kind of thing. And I had been helping to develop the style and the living section, and it was had this really great editor there. And, you know, we were three martini lunch girls, and we, you know, this was pre-recession. And, you know, it was still very, like, Rachel Zoe world and, you know, logo bags and blah, 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 blah. There, like, eccentricity, individualism, heritage, movement was not really in style. But, like, that was all that we were about. I mean, we liked, you know, ironically speaking, you know, like, white gloves, red lipstick, you know, old guard movies, fast-talking dames, that kind of thing. And one day, over one of our three martini lunches, as we were figuring out content for the style or the living vertical, we were like, I just brought up this idea. And I said, well, why don't we do a column of things that we would love to bring back from bygone eras? And she said, go for it, because we could do whatever we wanted. And so we did it. And my God, the response that it got was nuts. Like, it just seemed like everybody had something that they really wanted to bring back from times past. And, you know, suggestions kept pouring in. So we did another column and it got more and more popular. And then we did, you know, Let's Bring Back Mad Men edition, you know, when that came out, and that got like 800 comments in the first hour. And so we definitely felt like we had hit upon a nerve. And so Let's Bring Back, which had begun as a column, became a book. And now it's a series of books that are volume specific. The first one was a general encyclopedia, forgotten yet delightful, like foods, fashions, personalities, landmarks, words, that sort of thing. That came out in 2010, and now we're starting to roll out a series of topic-specific editions, and the one that just came out is the cocktail edition.
So, yeah, tell me about, you know, your research in creating this book, and what was that like for you?
In the cocktail book or the original one? Well, I mean, I earned a lot of hangovers. the book has 144 forgotten historical cocktails. I mean, so when you open up the book, you're not going to see like a sidecar or a Ward 8 or a martini or a Manhattan, because those classic cocktails, they're back already. Everybody knows how to make them. So these, I was really trying to concentrate on genuinely lost historical cocktails. So I was in archives. It was awesome. And And New York Public Library has a really amazing vintage menu collection, and you know, that was really fun. And actually the press that I profiled that I was telling you about, that was in Newburgh, they had like a vintage cocktail book library that went back to the 1800s, and it was really great. So I read a lot, and then of course we had to, the recipes that we ended up choosing, I had to test them to make sure that they weren't putrid, and you know, some of them were, so they didn't make the cut. So, and I'm kind of a lightweight, so it was definitely a deeply committed process. Of the 144 recipes in the book, 143 of them are awesome. There's one of them in there that's totally repulsive, and it has been included because it is so repulsive. It's hilariously repulsive. It's called the gingivitis cocktail.
Oh, God. What does it consist of? Because that sounds a bit terrifying. And also, how many times did you have to drink that in order to test it?
Okay, I'm going to be totally honest. I couldn't even bring myself to test it. it's how I have it categorized as the least appetizing drink name in history. I don't know what this bartender was thinking and who he made it for and who actually drank it at one point, but it's an ounce of gin, half an ounce of grenadine, 1 teaspoon of cream, and it's shaken with ice. And, you know, think about it, grenadine and cream. I mean, those are the components of a really repulsive mouth.
Oh, that is disgusting.
But for me, it's kind of denoted, it had to be included because it denoted to me the kind of warped humor that often went into cocktails over the years. And, you know, that was a common thread for most of these cocktails, was, you know, that mischievous humor. I really wanted to showcase that in the book.
We're going to take a very quick break, but when we get back, we have a lot more from author Leslie Bloom. You are listening to You Look Hungry. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Onions Milk by Iggy Dean on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Man, Joe, your computer is so slow, I can't even use this thing.
Yeah, I should probably get a new one. Do you have any suggestions?
Oh, totally, man. You should go to TechServe.
Okay, what's so good about TechServe?
Well, they've got this awesome new insider program that's free when you get a new Mac with AppleCare. So you should buy your computer there because you get 50% off data transfer, free loaner computers, front-of-the-line repair privileges, an annual Mac tune-up service, backup consultation and setup, seminars, and much more.
Okay, yeah, where's TechServe?
It's at 119 West 23rd Street in New York City. They're New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, and you should totally check out TechServe.com for more information.
All right, that settles it. I'm headed to TechServe.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I am still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by author Leslie Bloom. We are discussing the amazing book that she's just released. It's called Let's Bring Back the Cocktail Edition. And before the break, we were just discussing, you know, some of the more unattractive recipes that got into the book. And I want to know, what is one of your favorite recipes, almost to a deadly degree, that you find yourself drinking more often than not, I guess?
there are a couple of recipes in this book that are so unbelievably good that I have to stay away from them because they just go down way too easily and make me very naughty. Actually, I think I met you the first time while I was under the influence of something called the June Bride. And that is a 1920s drink, I think. And it was a gin, egg white, lemon juice, super fine sugar, and You can use any liqueur of your choice, but we were using elderflower, and you shake it with ice, and it's just like painfully good. You know, there's another one that I really like also, and it's called The Monkey Gland. I know that sounds completely repulsive, and like you really wouldn't want to go anywhere near it, but it's pretty sick also. And it was another, you know, early 20th century drink, and in the early 20th century there was this really kind of vile but evocative fad about monkey glands, and some a particular doctor was grafting monkey testicles onto the testicles of men for it was like it wasn't ever stated that it was an aphrodisiac. It was supposed to be like a big anti-aging thing, but it became such a big deal that E.E. Cummings mentioned it in a poem. And of course, because, you know, history's bartenders are so funny, you know, they've commemorated it with a cocktail. And I'm sure that it must have been fun as hell to walk into a bar in, you know, the old days and be like, give me a monkey gland. And that's gin, orange juice, grenadine, absinthe, and shaken with ice. And it definitely packs a punch. Anytime you're using, you know, absinthe as an accent in a cocktail, you know, you're going to go down. But it's pretty gorgeous.
So there's so many topics within this book. I mean, you discuss ancient Romans, 17th century clergy, pyromaniac gilded age bartenders, flappers, etc. I mean, tell me about a time period and a cocktail that you feel kind of illustrates that period and, you know, a social, I guess, shift or whatever the case in that era that you really gravitate towards and think is interesting.
Sure. So I think what I'll probably talk about is the Blue Blazer cocktail. And so in the mid 18, I always get the centuries. So it's in the 1800s, mid 1800s, there was a legendary bartender named Jerry Thomas. And so at that time, like a lot of other bartenders, they were like whiskey slingers, you know, they were saloon slingers, but not Jerry Thomas. I mean, he was highly presentational, and he's credited with being the father of mixology, and he really elevated the art of cocktail presentation. And he, you know, for instance, he wore like a stiff white shirt, supposedly, you know, reportedly, with, you know, diamond studs down the front. And he also reportedly had a silver bar set, and he went on tour of the European capitals and you know, showed off his art of cocktail making. And so, you know, again, where most people were just, you know, drinking, you know, Kentucky bourbon, slugging it down, he created a variety of cocktails that are still pretty amazing, and the Blue Blazer was one of them. And it's a boiling water, scotch, and sugar with it, and you have two mugs, and you set the liquid on fire, and you pour the blue flame back and forth between the two mugs. And it was just so presentational and so incredible. I mean, can you imagine at that period of time seeing just, I guess, drinking move in this, you know, pyrotechnic incredible direction? I mean, and so for me, that really makes a statement about how Thomas was moving the art of drinking into the realm of art, as opposed to just, you know, gasping around on the floor after drinking, you know, 50 shots in a row like they do in the HBO series Deadwood. So I really think that one is a good period drink.
If you could kind of pick a cocktail, I mean, we're definitely in a very cocktail centric culture these days, mm-hmm. and maybe think of like a cocktail that describes a cultural point in contemporary U.S. or internationally or whatever it is. What do you think is maybe a trend that people are doing right now?
I think, I mean, if you're going to pick a cultural point, I think that, you know, a turning point for bringing cocktails back, you know, there were two in, you know, the last decade or so, and the first was the Cosmopolitan on Sex and the City. And then, you know, then with Mad Men coming back, I think that it brought back a lot of, you know, classic cocktails like the Martini and the Manhattan and that kind of thing. So those, you know, really helped to regenerate a cocktail culture and, you know, in our environment. But I feel like when you go into really innovative bars today, the envelope is being pushed again. And, you know, we're really looking at artisanal cocktails that are using, you know, herbs, and, you know, egg whites are like nothing, you know, I mean, that's like just a given that will be done. And I think that in the way that people are becoming, or chefs are becoming intensely creative and heritage oriented, but also forward looking in creating, you know, food, I think that that's definitely a trend in cocktail making now as well. But it's interesting because it really does have an eye on the past. You know, so I mean, it's like a lot of these people who are serving you are going to wear handlebar mustaches, and they will, you know, really use very heritage-oriented brands of alcohol, but at the same time, they're just being so intensely creative with using really modern ingredients and really modern interpretations of older drinks.
If you could pick an author, dead or living, where would you take them to drink? Could be in New York City or anywhere in the world. And what would you drink with them?
Oh my God. I mean, this question might kill me.
It's a very difficult. I was thinking about this for myself, and it, you know, I would never, I don't think I could handle Stephen King or Ernest Hemingway, and Cormac McCarthy would just, I feel like I would have to drink a straight bottle of bourbon just to keep
up. I don't know that you want to drink with those boys.
Exactly. I can't. Those are people that I couldn't drink with, but.
Well, I mean, Hemingway, I mean, he supposedly invented a slew of drinks, and one of them was called Death in the Afternoon, and it's absinthe and champagne, and he tells you have to drink 3 to 5 to get the full effect. So, I mean, you're drinking with that guy, you're going down.
You're definitely going down, yeah.
I feel like maybe the whole point of drinking with somebody, for me anyway, is to really bring out the best in them, and so I feel like I'd love to drink with a really glorious storyteller, and I think for me, two people... who I'd love to drink with. And I have to figure out where I would take them in a minute, but I'm going to start with who they are first. And the first is Truman Capote. I mean, can you imagine how unbelievably naughty he would have gotten after a few drinks and the things that you would learn and how fun he would be until he went, you know, a few drinks too far, which he really did, you know, a lot in the last, you know, 15 years of his life. And that wasn't fun. But I feel like if you had caught Capote in, you know, the early 60s and were drinking with him someplace amazing like Le Cote Basque or, you know, the 21 Club. And then the other one would be Karen Blixen, you know, Isaac Dinesen, who wrote Out of Africa. And she just seems like she would have just have been such an elegant drinker. And after two glasses of wine, just these beautiful stories would have unfolded. And it just would have been this erudite, yet like strangely bohemian for that period of time experience. Where would I have taken her? God, I don't know. What would be worthy of Karen Blixen in contemporary New York? I feel like she would have had to invite us over to her place, you know, in Kenya to you know, have that experience be properly awesome.
That was very well said. And your answers were much better than mine. I think, you know, if I drank with Hemingway, it would definitely end in
tears
or the hospital or a lot of regret. But, you know,
or you just would have been so, like, appalled by his behavior that you just wouldn't even be able to, like, lift your drink to your lips.
Yeah. Although, I guess, in a weird way, I'd really like to take him to Koreatown and make him sing karaoke and have, like, a sort of, like, BYOB experience. Because I feel like that could be really crazy. I don't know. You know, so on the horizon, you have Let's Bring Back the Lost Language Edition. And you're going to have a line of ancillary products. There's also going to be a line of Let's Bring Back inspired jewelry. And I mean, tell me more about sort of as much as you can kind of tell us about, you know, what is happening in the future with these projects.
Well, the next Let's Bring Back that comes out, as you mentioned, is the Lost Language Edition. And that just chronicles words, phrases, insults, you know, from times gone past, and it's my baby. I love this book. Like, I totally adore it. I'm really obsessed with lost language, and I mean, I carried a little notebook with me for 3 years while I was researching this, and like everything from like a Jean Harlow film to Shakespeare in the Park to like mid-century food advertisements was fodder for finding, you know, turns of phrase that are just not in use anymore. And I love it. And when I was writing this book, my poor husband would come home from work, and I would like plaster him to the couch and like regale him with, you know, that day's discoveries, and it was pretty awesome. And it has been turned into a jewelry line that I did with a jewelry house called Lulu Frost, which specializes in heritage jewelry. And it was inspired by three Let's Bring Back muses, Elsa Schiaparelli, the surrealist designer, Nancy Cunard, who was an activist, 1920s heiress, and then the Marquesa Casati, and who was a wild, I don't even know how you describe her. She was just a sublime degenerate who lived in Venice in the Belle Epoque. And we created a series of jewelry pieces around each of the women. So we're having a lot of fun with this concept. And I've been pretty astonished by the breadth of applications for Let's Bring Back. And, you know, right now I'm talking with Lipstick Queen Poppy King, who has a really amazing line of makeup, and we're creating, you know, some Let's Bring Back makeup that looks at heritage makeup, and it's just been fun. It's just amazing. I think one of the things that's so awesome is when you're getting into products that are inspired by the past, I mean, you're really, it's allowing you to relive the past in a very specific three-dimensional way, and it's been really great.
What is one of your favorite lost languages, so to speak? I mean, is there like a particular time period or something that you feel is, close to your heart?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, like with the cocktail book, I looked back to all the way to Roman times, and the same thing happened with, Lost Language Edition. I feel like, you know, the 1920s and 30s were just incredibly colorful, and it's Prohibition actually gave rise to some pretty incredible, like just hilarious turns of phrase. So I feel like the book is pretty heavy in that area, but I mean it's spread, you know, across a wide array of things. And I think one of the things that was so amazing is that some words that we have are so they've had different meanings over the centuries. So one word can mean, you know, itself now, and then it means something completely different in 20 or 30 years later. And I'm trying to remember the name of one of the words. It's like there was a word for sardine, so consider the word oyster. Like, you know, we think of the word oyster, and it just means to us like a mollusk. But you know, if you had gone back 100 years, you know, it meant a jolly good guy. And if you went back, you know, 100 years before that, it meant a gob of phlegm. You know, so yeah, it's pretty amazing how many different connotations words have over the centuries.
So Let's Bring Back the Cocktail Edition is out. It's Chronicle Books, and you can get it on Amazon. What other places can you locate it?
Happily, Chronicle and this book series are great favorites of independent booksellers, and so you can buy them anywhere, and most independent booksellers. It's very well stocked in New York, and you can also buy it directly from Chronicle's website, which is really great. Chronicle is it's a small San Francisco-based publishing company, and I, you know, love to support them directly. And you can buy it from Barnes & Noble, and pretty much anywhere, indie-bound. It's out there.
It is the most beautiful cover, and it's a very useful book. It's a beautiful book, and it's informational. It's delicious. I've tried one too many of the drinks in this book, and it's just in time for the holiday season as well. So for all of you listeners out there, I highly recommend going out and just checking it off the list, because everyone can use this book. And Leslie, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Oh, it's so fun to be here. And your listeners have no way of knowing this, but there's actually a warthog head right above my shoulder right now and a glass of wine in front of me, so this couldn't have been more delightful.
It is true. It is very true. He's staring at us very intensely. But, as always, thanks to Joe Galarraga, Jack Inslee, and the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio Network and Roberta's. I'll see y'all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.